Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Well, you may know and love Allplay Brands for their amazing line of games. Did you know that they also carry games from other amazing partner publishers? Publishers like Cardboard Alchemy, who has Flamecraft Duels and Critter Kitchen, both lined up for the Origins Awards this year. Druid City Games with titles such as Wonderland's War and Tidal Blades. Kinsenki with Galactic Cruise that just won the Golden Geek. Post Curious with numerous award-winning puzzle tale games. And Bitewing Games with their new two-player line that has been a huge hit. Plus so many more. So definitely head over to allplay.com to see all these amazing games from both Allplay and their partners. Plus, there's only a $4 flat shipping fee if you live in the United States. So check them out. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 144, Waypoints. Today, we are joined by Matthew Dunstan, freelance game designer, but also if you haven't looked him up, he has so many credits and he didn't let me list it, but thank you for being on the show. So happy to have you.
Thanks for having me, Danielle. You still slipped it in there. I told you not to say anything. I wanted to keep a mystery for all the listeners, you know, like, who is this person?
Yeah, well, also, there's not that many Australian game designers that people know, and I feel like I've only had one other one on the show, so now you're my number two.
I'm very honored to be literally doubling the representation of my home country.
Yeah, I know. I really need to work on that, or maybe Australia needs to work on it. I'm not really sure who's at fault here.
Oh, you need to come out to Australia and do a whole bunch of interviews out here. It's a great place to visit.
I would love that. I have been only once, and it was just to Sydney, so like, there's a lot to explore.
There's a whole continent left, yeah. I think you'll find something good in all of that.
The problem is my phobia of snakes, which unfortunately you do have a little icon on for your game, but like, I get it. When you go hiking, that's my number one fear, is that I'm going to run into a danger noodle.
But on the other hand, we have the most advanced research into antivenom, I think, or like one of the most. So we're well prepared. So you'd be well looked after. Don't worry.
Excellent. Glass half full. Well, okay. For anyone who doesn't know you like I do, mind talking about how you got into designing board games?
Sure. So I played games when I was younger, but I sort of reconnected with modern board games around university. I've been someone who always is sort of interested in like the looking behind the curtain of any kind of activity I do or making money from it or anything like that. So for example, you know, when I played sport, I actually frequently became a referee or an umpire in a lot of those sports. You know, I was sort of interested in doing something else behind it. And the same kind of happened for games. I got into playing games and it was a couple of years after that I was like, oh, I wonder, you know, how do these things get made? Can I try to make one? And so that was about 15, 16 years ago now. I was in Australia at the time, but I moved to the UK, and that was a really kind of fortunate thing in that, you know, at the time in Australia, there wasn't so much of a game design scene or even a board game scene that, you know, people were playing board games, so we didn't get as many of sort of the modern games coming out here necessarily. But when I moved to the UK, I met Brett Gilbert, who is another game designer who I've made a lot of games with, and he's made a lot of his games of his own as well. And we started this playtesting group in Cambridge. I kind of stalked him online to work out where he lived, and it turned out it was the same place that I was moving to. He had a blog, you know, it was like so far ago that he had a blog that was really, really good, and I'm really sad that he deleted it, actually. He has some really interesting thoughts about game design, which are quite different to what you would read elsewhere. But we started meeting, and that was sort of the start of me, you know, really taking it, you know, semi-seriously. It was still like a hobby, but we would meet every week, and I was working on one or two games. I entered a game design competition that I was a finalist in. That was in 2011, 2012. I didn't win, but then surprisingly, the contest organizers, without telling me, pitched my game to publishers at that Essen. Then I get an email, you know, a week or two after Essen, saying from Days of Wonder, saying they want to publish my game.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, and I hadn't met them at all at that point. I had no idea that my game had been shown to them. And so, yeah, I had a pretty magical sort of start in the kind of professional side of the industry. And working with them was a really incredible experience. So that became Relic Runners, which was my first game released in 2013. From there, I just kept going. I was really fortunate that living in the UK, they had the UK Games Expo, which in the time I lived there, over that 10 years, it grew, you know, almost exponentially. Now it's a really big convention, actually. And I also got to go to Essen every year. It was reasonably inexpensive, probably actually cost less for me to fly from the UK to Germany than some Americans to get to Gen Con, potentially.
Oh, God, yeah. Gen Con is ridiculous. Mostly the hotels. That's the bad part.
Back in the day, actually, Essen was a bit better. But now I know when I go, it is like getting to Gen Con levels of difficulty. But Germany has functioning public transport, which widens the available, like what you're able to, where you can stay. I can't say the same for Indianapolis from my memories of being there. People have been happy to keep making my games, and I've been able to work with some really great designers and publishers. And as of, you know, about 5 years ago, I've been a full-time board game designer, which, you know, I consider a huge, you know, privilege and a lot of good fortune to be able to do that. And I hope it'll continue as long as I can.
What made you take the leap to go full-time freelance?
So I had been, you know, I'd had games released for about 8 or 9 years. I had a lot of games that had gone out. I didn't have any sort of massive, you know, evergreen hit or anything like that. But I had a few games that were narrative games that were probably going to be series, one of which was the adventure games with Cosmos. And I think at the time, maybe the first two or three had come out, and they'd done well enough that I could see that there was going to be this, you know, I started to see some of my games having a reasonable amount of income over at least more than 1 year. Most games just sell a bunch, you know, when they're released, and then they disappear to nothing. So that was one side that I had a bit of, confidence that I'd be able to keep making money from games that already existed. I wasn't just relying on signing new games. And the other honest part is that I actually wouldn't have done it had I not, in my actual job, it's a very long story, but basically they couldn't keep employing me. It was during COVID. I left the UK. My now wife is from the Czech Republic, and I got into Prague before they closed the borders and, you know, all the shutdowns and everything like that. So it just made things complicated for my work. So my decision was made for me, but I was very fortunate to obviously have game designing as something that I could not just fall back on, but actually embrace and spend even more time on.
It's crazy how the world works like that. I feel like COVID started so many careers and then also shifted so many.
Well, I mean, and, you know, as we'll, I guess, talk about with Postmark Games, so it's a print and play company that I founded with Rory Muldoon. That's also a product of COVID. So we kickstarted our first game, Voyages, at the end of 2021. And we had something like 13,000 backers for a, you know, £5 print and play, which I don't think anyone had really, I mean, we certainly hadn't ever thought that was going to happen. You know, we thought, oh, maybe we'll get 100, 200 people, you know, possibly. It was kind of like a little indie project, but it was just the perfect time. It was around the time where all the shipping, you know, everything was getting delayed, shipping prices were, you know, skyrocketing. And the fact that we could launch this game that everybody would get pretty much immediately after they backed it, we did it in December and they got it all before Christmas, resonated with people. That was an incredible springboard. And yeah, COVID was certainly a part of that.
It's so fascinating because I also started my career, I would say, because of COVID, in combination of moving things around, going digital, learning how to do digital playtesting helped me a lot. But also in the United States, like, we had Black Lives Matter and some other stuff that happened that made the United States publishers especially try to open their doors to new female designers, or really anyone of a marginalized, like historically marginalized group, have the ability to pitch. So me, who didn't have any credits under her name, got opportunities to meet publishers that would have never met with me had unfortunate historic events not happened.
You could only make the most of the opportunities that are given to you. And I think that was like your proof of taking those opportunities and running with them. But yeah, it's a pity that it takes a massive worldwide catastrophic event to actually produce those opportunities. I mean, I also make YouTube videos, although I'm on a bit of a hiatus at the moment. But, you know, I try and talk a little bit about the finances of being a game designer and the industry in large. And it's really it's still a hugely kind of privileged position to be a game designer at all, let alone make a living from it. And I'd love to just find ways to improve that and change that, because I think there's obviously a lot of money in the board game industry. It's not that people aren't buying games or that companies aren't making money, but it's the creatives at the heart of it. Most of the time, living pretty vicariously, or can only do it as a hobby or a side thing. If we're going to become more professional, if the whole industry is going to become more professional, which I think it kind of is, we don't have a choice about it, because businesses and hedge funds are coming in and buying up publishers and they're kind of professionalizing it for us. We have to find ways to let that happen also for the creative people, and to improve the kind of possibility for people to make a living from game design, because that should be an option. That shouldn't be the start of a joke, you know, how do you make money as a board game designer? You start with a lot of money, kind of thing. It shouldn't be that, you know. It should be that we're valuable creatives who are the linchpin to a huge industry, and that, you know, should be remunerated and be able to, you know, live a decent life being part of that industry. So yeah, I'm really interested in trying to unpick like what are the bits that we can kind of change or improve upon that we can influence. I know it's a huge global system, but even just thinking about how long you take from the point when you start designing to the point you even make your first dollar, or like, you know, the first bit after an advance, it's often like on the scale of like 4 to 5 years or something like that.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, and how can anybody, it's only the most privileged of people who have savings or have time or have partners who are able to support them or anything like that, that can put in the time of those 5 years and not make any money from something. How do you shorten that? How do you have better opportunities to kind of bring that forward so people can think about, you know, I'm not saying you're going to go full-time straight away, but that you can actually see some return on your effort and your ideas and your work in a much more timely fashion. So you might have the confidence to actually change things around and go, okay, well, I might go part-time, or, you know, there is some sort of future in that. Whereas now it's really much more about, you know, a lucky set of circumstances that people find themselves being full-time, I think, rather than any sort of idea of a career path or something that you can really aim at, which, yeah, needs to change, I think.
I completely agree. Every year, Cardboard Edison, or maybe it's every other year, they'll reach out to designers to kind of put in information on what your contract looks like, to just kind of see what are the standards. And oh my God, are they all over the place? Because even when I was looking through, I realized that I look at my contracts almost like I look at Kickstarters, where I back something and then I forget about it until it shows up. And that's pretty much my next paycheck after the advance. And yeah, it's maybe not the best choice, but it almost maybe mental health-wise might be, but that's like not how it should be.
No, I mean, I think it's every 5 years, because I remember that, it sounds like a bit of humble brag, but I have a lot of contracts to submit to that when it comes up. And yeah, I'm the same, like you go, but I mean, not only is it, yeah, you might forget the details of the contract, but the difficulties in this industry also is, as much as we like to focus on contracts being important for new designers to understand and, you know, what clauses you want to see in there, all that sort of thing, my experience, at least, is actually that you're still in a very vulnerable position as a designer, even if you have a good contract, because realistically, very little things are actually enforceable. I just sort of say that, like, I found, like, you know, the contract doesn't mean much if things go badly, unfortunately. Being a global industry, often you're, you know, signing games with publishers in different countries, and the ability to, you know, have any kind of legal recourse is rather limited or very costly in that case. So yeah, it's even things like that, and the rise of something like TTGDA. Sorry, I get confused because the American one is TTGGA.
Yeah, the Tabletop Game Designer Association. I hope found that because I had been screwed over many times over by contracts or by people I had worked for. And I'm like, I'm over this. I'm down to try to help make this a little better.
Yeah, and I think it's great to see that in the English-speaking world. Like, obviously, I had SAZ for a long time in Germany and French organization as well, whose name is eluding me right now. But yeah, exactly. I've been really impressed with that. That's the kind of thing you need, right? Like, that's the kind of collective support, and that hopefully can extend to financial and legal support. That also is a great thing. That's only one part of a much bigger picture to improve the kind of lot for designers. And I think I'm always also very interested in how do you have ways for designers to really learn from each other in that kind of professional sense. You know, the great thing about game design is we're so accessible in a way. Like, there's, you know, social media, at least when I started and Twitter wasn't the hellfire it was now, it was such an amazing way to start in game design. You felt very connected to even like very established designers who would often be quite happy to share their thoughts or chat messages. And you sort of have a lot of this public information, which is great, but there's a lot of information which is sort of unsaid, or you know, designers don't want to talk, you know, badly about publishers or about sensitive details. But how do you help newer designers if there's a lot of this sort of unspoken information that's going around? And if you're in the right network, you'll get access to that. But if you're not, then you won't. And something like TTGGA is also, I think, doing a really good job of that as well, like trying to disseminate even kind of more sensitive or personal facts or information about working in the industry, which is also hugely important.
I totally agree. And you do a YouTube channel, even if you're on hiatus, talking about this stuff. I do this podcast. I have another podcast and I do these short form videos, but it's like, It's nice seeing that there are quite a few designers and publishers that are giving these free resources out there. And so it's great when you have someone like Tabletop Game Designer Association putting those links into a single page to make it a little easier, so you're not just like going down the Google rabbit hole. But it's nice. I think it's getting better in a lot of ways, and people are learning from each other. Kind of like when you play a game, you get inspired by it, and maybe it gives you a piece of what you put into your next game. So it's like, hopefully we're all trying to help make it a little bit better.
No, definitely. And actually, a huge shout out to Chris and Suzanne at Cardboard Edison. I mean, we already talked about it, but like, if I think about who's been doing the longest in terms of like really bringing together great information about game design, pretty much completely selflessly, like, you know, they've been doing it for so long. And also, you know, incredible things like the Cardboard Edison Award and the compendium, like that's also a huge benefit to the community. So yeah, huge thanks to them as well.
It's great. And if you're an established game designer, think about being one of the judges for the award. It is awesome. And if you're a less established or just starting, try applying to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's knowing the kind of work that like goes in from the judging side, like that we really try hard to like give really, you know, useful, constructive feedback. It's not just, you know, like yay or nay, 6 out of 10 kind of thing. And I think it's really encouraged for all the judges to put that effort in. It's of such great value, even greater. I think just entering design competitions full stop is really useful for beginning designers. But on top of that, I think the quality of feedback that you get from the Cardboard Edison Award from such a wide group of judges, they've got judges from all types of backgrounds all over the world, all different types of games. Just enter. And if you have the chance to be a judge, so I know that's something they sort of struggle with, because as the competition gets more and more popular and more people enter,
they need more and more judges.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I've seen the email, you know, like the kind of like, oh, can you judge a few more?
They're like, hey, can you do 8 more? Yeah. Can you do this many more? And I'm like, I really can't. I felt so bad this year. I did not time it out well where I could work and do it, but I was like, next year I'm all in, I'll make sure not to plan any kind of trips or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think I'd encourage, you know, more people, even if you had 1 published game, 2 published games, I think you could still have a really great, you know, really useful feedback to other designers. And no, I think no game is judged by a single person, it's always, you know, 2 or 3 people at least. So yeah, don't feel like it's all resting on your shoulders either.
Yeah, but here, let's wrap back around to the game that is supposed to be our spotlight.
we're just tricking everybody. We're getting them in with like...
We're teaching them all about game industry knowledge, not actual game designing. But let's talk about Waypoints. And I guess let's start with where that inspiration came from and then how to play it.
Context for that is that, so it's one of the Postmark games. So it's a print and play game. It's the third one that we have released, and we released it a few years ago now. One of the things that, a bit like it as a designer, you grow as you make designs and you get better at different things. I like to think sometimes you make things more elegant or you find better ways to do things. You know, when we were making Postmark, we were kind of learning as we were going along what kind of works as a print play game, and also what was our sort of advantage or what's our speciality, I guess. What are we bringing that only we can do in that space? And I think something we really realized is that, so for those who don't know Rory, I think is one of, despite not only being a really great game designer, and he's had a few published games to his name as well, such as Scorer, but he is, I think, one of the most underrated artists, graphic designers in working in the industry full stop. I don't think he would come up on many people's, you know, like top 5 or top 10 lists. You know, he has this incredible ability to condense quite complex information into not only like really readable, usable layouts, so really great UX design, but also can really make it very beautiful and have a really strong style. And he could do that in lots of different styles. When we got into working on more games for Postmark, I think I realized for me, and I've taken probably more of a design lead on a lot of our games, I tend to have the ideas, although I should say Voyages was Rory's idea. I just latched onto his good ideas. I didn't contribute so much. I mean, I helped develop the game initially, but you realize that as I start designing the games, more and more I'm bringing Rory in really early on in the process. So I'll make a first sheet of a new idea, and it'll look terrible because I have zero artistic ability. It'll look like a black and white. I don't know if he makes the joke, but all of my prototypes are in like Myriad Pro because it's like the Illustrator default. I don't even like bother to like change fonts or anything. It's just all my prototypes look the same.
I mean, it's not Comic Sans, so you know.
It's not Comic Sans. I mean, that would be a very strong calling card to like pitch your games only in Comic Sans or like Papyrus. Maybe I should try and like troll some publishers one year.
Okay, well, wait, no, there's actually a really good SNL skit with Papyrus or whatever. Yeah, look it up after this.
I will check it out. So I do this really rough one and I'll play it with him really early on because I kind of need his buy-in, not just in terms of like a setting or whether, you know, he likes the idea, but whether he can see a way how he might represent that, both in terms of a theme, in terms of a style, in terms of how you can fit the information on the sheet. And it's a very iterative process between game design, UX, illustration, graphic design from the very start. And it means that we make games in a really specific way that I, you know, like it's not the same way I make other games that I might pitch to publishers. It also means that I have a really good sense of even what ideas might be interesting to take them because we can do things that I couldn't do in other ways. And Waypoints is a really great example. I had this idea basically of a map game. And I just could see, you know, like when you take out the, what are they called? Like the orienteering maps or OSM maps with the contours on them. Having that, that is the game sheet. And that I sort of started that. I was like, wow, that actually, and drawing you moving across that landscape, it's such a resonant thing that people can really connect with. And I think a lot of people really love doing and evoking that, you know, going outdoors and hiking, which a lot of people love. I was fortunate enough at the very start to have a very clear game mechanic to marry to that, which was just this idea that as you would move across the map, you would spend energy or points or whatever as you crossed contour lines and also as you crossed grid lines. So the idea would be that the grid lines would kind of measure like the distance you're going, so you'd cost you more as you moved across the grid lines, but the contours were kind of a somewhat like a flexibility that you had. Like you could cross them if you wanted to, you know, you could go uphills or downhills if you wanted to specifically go in that direction. Or you could in fact, you know, draw your line in a, you know, very freeform way as you often do when you're walking at like you try to walk at the same elevation, you go around a hill or something like that. And you could try and draw that line so you weren't crossing any contours. So you're sort of minimizing the number of points you were spending to move. Just that core idea and what it resulted on the map, it, you know, as you were drawing your path, it looked really natural because it was completely freeform. You weren't, you know, ticking boxes or you didn't have to, you could just draw your line however you want. And you were just, the cost of it was how many lines you crossed as you were drawing that line. I knew that that idea could work so well with Rory because being able to have that style and how to kind of represent information on that. And I was looking actually just before we started the podcast, I was looking back through the prototype versions and it was really only from the very first rough idea, you know, to something which was pretty much what Waypoints became, you know, plus or minus some development. It was basically 2 weeks, two or three versions or something in 2 weeks. It was just such a clear idea and it was something that fits so clearly into what we were doing as Postmark and what our strengths were. That I was really happy with that. Of course, like there was a lot of work after that to do, you know, like, okay, what are you collecting? And, you know, the idea in Waypoints is that you travel from Waypoint to Waypoint. So Waypoints are specific places on the map. There's, you know, a lot of them scattered across the map. And every turn you have a certain number of movement points to move to a new Waypoint. So you're sort of going point to point and you have to make sure you have enough movement points to get to whatever waypoint you're going to. And there are some ways to mitigate that or go further than you might be normally allowed to do. And then you're kind of collecting things based on the waypoints you visit. So normally you have a set of three different animals. And as you collect more of the same animal, you get more points or you get bonuses, which might help you break the movement rules in different ways. You always usually have binoculars, which let you look at a different waypoint in an adjacent grid point. And then you have lots of different other things that go into the different maps. And the other reason, actually, I mean, just thinking why it even worked even better, because with Postmark Games, we'd also always set up the company that what's a real advantage of print play games is that you can do effectively DLC. You know, it's very hard often when you publish traditionally or pitch your games to a traditional publisher, it's a real risk for them to publish expansions. I remember talking to a publisher once who basically said they can only make an expansion if the sales of the base game are actually going up, because they always expect that if the sales of a base game are going up, then an expansion might have level sales. If the sales of the base game are level, which by the way is already really good, if you're selling the same amount of a game year in, year out, I mean, that's a success. But even in that case, they would expect the sales of an expansion to exponentially drop off. And so actually it's not necessarily a very good idea to do that. Print play, you don't have that issue. We send you the file, we can make you can print as many as you want. So from the very start, we always had with our games the idea that when you back them or when they were first produced, usually they would have like one or two maps, one or two different sheets, which are almost different scenarios or different expansions. And then we would release usually up to five or six sheets for each game. And when you buy our games, you get access to a Dropbox folder, which always has sort of the most up-to-date version of the game. And so as we release new content for the game, you just get it for free. So with that model, and then you go, oh, it's literally a game about maps. Okay, we can do like a different map. Now we've done five different maps for waypoints. It also suggests such great, like, it's so easy to think about what different map, you know, we had one map in the snow where you're skiing, doing cross-country skiing. We had one sort of on the coast and you're taking ferries to different islands. We've got one in the desert. It's sort of vaguely based on the Grand Canyon without actually calling it the Grand Canyon. It all just flowed really well, and it was a really enjoyable experience to work from, you know, from the base game and making new sheets. You know, I made a few videos about Postmark games, and I really find sometimes that with print and play games, you have, it's such a constrained space in a way. Like, you don't have the luxury of lots of different components. I should say that our approach to print play was always to minimize the amount of effort for players as possible. So all our games, you just print off a sheet. You don't do any cutting, or you're not making any cards or other components or tiles. And we just ask players to usually provide some sort of common component. Like, they might need some pens to draw on the sheets, or they might need a few dice, or a few of our more recent games have used a standard deck of playing cards. And so we don't want a lot of overhead for people to sort of get into the game. So you're starting in this really constrained space, and the fact that we're trying to make games that are, I guess, somewhat spatial, or really like showing off Rory's abilities and you know, that kind of way we approach it. It sort of just means that there's not a lot of false ideas. I don't know how to put it. Like, you know, when you start designing, you think of an idea and you start working on it. You're like, oh, this might be fun. And, you know, some percentage of those don't go anywhere because you're like, oh, no, it's not very fun. Or sometimes they go somewhere and you finish it. But with Postmark, because there's so many constraints, you sort of know from the idea point whether it's going to work or not, almost. And so many of our games come together actually quite quickly. Not because the games were sort of easy, but, you know, like, it's so easy to just discard ideas before you even work on them, because you just, it's much easier to tell if they're not going to work or not. And that means the ideas that do make it through that kind of screening process are just often so much closer to a finished game, you know, from the very start. And so often things go, you know, relatively smoothly, which we've been fortunate to do.
That's really cool. I know for me, when I looked at the game, I was like, oh yeah, I grew up reading maps. I had to learn that in elementary school. That was a thing that we had to do. And I've been hiking a ton. I'm actually, as we're recording, about to go hike the Grand Canyon and Zion. But when this airs, it'll be after that. So very much the theme resonates with me. I look at it and I understand how it works. And I love the fact that the weather conditions is how much movement you get, because also super relate to when it's bad weather, you're going to be stuck. And I do love how accessible this is and how you guys have created it, where you can print in like low ink or black and white or whatever variations a person might need in order to like make this work.
Yeah, we did. I mean, again, that was something we, from the very first campaign for Voyages, we made a really good point about that kind of accessibility. Yeah, exactly. So if you have a terrible printer, or you want to print at work that's only black and white or something, or at a library or something, you could do that. So yeah, we prioritize. And it's not just it's not just a black and white version of the existing sheet. Rory designs those low ink versions specifically, you know, with textures and things that give you that same kind of contrast, so that you can actually, you know, that they're still usable and they still look good. And also we did a lot of work, not exactly educating, but showing people how they could play digitally. You know, there are a lot of some good programs where you can just, you know, upload a JPEG or a PDF and draw on it, even in a web browser, or play on your tablet. The company was also born during COVID, as we said. So a focus also was our games that, you know, that they could be played remotely. So that also necessitates certain ways of how they work. So they're kind of very flexible in a lot of those ways. And yeah, they definitely, you know, they all have to play well solo as well. A lot of circumstances go into the birth of Postmark games, and we just happened, that formula produced something that not only allowed us to make really great games, but that people, you know, kind of resonated with and saw the value in as well. So yeah, we've been very fortunate.
It is so cool innovating with constraints like that and it coming from that place.
It almost feels like cheating, actually, weirdly enough. Like, it is, I mean, you do feel sometimes a bit frustrated. Like, it's interesting, we've kind of done one game a year, and I sort of said how quickly the games come together. But so, you know, when you look at our releases, often we're kickstarting games near the end of the year, like November, December. So it looks like we had this plan, like one game a year, where is November? But what you don't see is often I don't even know what the game is until like August or September or something. Because I, like, you kind of, it sometimes takes a while to get that good idea, you know, like, and...
Oh, totally. You toss out a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, and I don't have, like, this bank of, you know, like, I don't have this sort of ready pile of, like, great ideas that are just waiting to be done. And so it can sort of be stressful in the other way, but... Yeah, it does when it comes together, and it does feel a bit like cheating because, yeah, you just works in prototyping is so easy, you know, like you're just making one sheet. It's super easy to iterate on. Just, I don't know, it also those constraints breed a lot of creativity. Like I said, we started making games with playing cards. That was also, you know, and having a few key insights about like what does having that component mean in terms of what you can do in a print play game. I made a video of that where I sort of, the main realization was that actually that a few other people had used playing cards as kind of randomizers and like sort of stand-ins for dice, for instance. You know, you would flip a card from a deck and, you know, depending on the rank or the suit or something, that would give you different options. But we kind of realized it's like, well, actually, if you have a deck of cards, you have 52 components. You know, you don't normally have many components for a print and play game. You know, you have the sheet and a pen or something or a couple of dice. But with a deck of cards, you have all these components. You can move them around. You can have them in particular places on the sheet. And kind of that realization suddenly meant that we could make something like 52 Realms or 52 Jewels. And our next game, actually, which will be kickstarted in July, we haven't really announced it, but it's going to use coins. And even kind of like thinking about like how can you use coins in an interesting way? What does that component do for you? Yeah, so I don't think we're going to run out of ideas. It'd just be how quickly I have good ones, I guess.
That's so cool. Yeah. And I mean, you guys are killing it, even with the game that we're talking about, Waypoints. That one won for Golden Geek, like a best print and play, I'm pretty sure, game award. A Golden Geek, I think.
I'm really kind of humbled. And actually, just as we record, you know, we got runner up for 52 Jewels for the Golden Geek for print and play this year. I feel a little bit, what's the word, sheepish? A little, well, you know, as Board Game Geek is, you know, user voted for the Golden Geeks. And of course, with print play games, it's often a lot of, you know, it's very indie. People who don't need the public, you know, huge publisher support. And actually, what I've been really happy with Postmark is we've seen, I think people have taken our example and kind of run with it and made their own games and own companies. And that's been amazing to see. But at the same time, we were lucky enough, I guess, to be quite early on. And because we had that really big Voyages campaign, we have quite a big mailing list. So it kind of does feel sometimes like, not that we're cheating, but like it's not exactly fair when you sort of, it's like, I don't know, if Ravensburger got to, you know, use their PR machine for every Golden Geek or something compared to much smaller companies or something like that. So I'm very grateful, but I also want to just, I think mainly more the point is that when people see the Golden Geek Awards, especially for print play, do like take a look at the whole list. And honestly, like I think anybody on that list, and there's also some great forums that are really championing print and play games, I'd really recommend checking out a lot of them, because even if, you know, Postmark games aren't your thing, I'm sure you can find something that will really jive with you. And it's just, it's a really creative space in the games industry, I think.
That is really cool. For this game in particular, did you like change much during development for it?
I think actually it's interesting you talk about the weather. That was probably the most difficult thing. So very briefly, in the game as it plays, you have along the four sides of the map. So you play over four days and you're going along one side. It has a little weather track. It's a series of spaces which have a number between, I think it's one and five or one and six. It sort of depends on the map. And at the start of your turn, you roll one die and that's how far everyone moves along that track. And whichever space they land on, that gives you a number, and that's how many movement points you get to use on that turn. When you get to the end of the track, you have to end. So if you, you know, like if you're on the penultimate space and you roll like a three, well, you still just stop on the last space, and you always get a certain number of movement on the last turn of the day. It took us a long time to actually settle on that system. I think it's actually a bit divisive because you don't know how many turns you're going to play in each round. If you roll really high, you'll move along the track really quickly, and you'll only have a few turns. Whereas if you roll consistently low, then you'll have more turns. We quite like that. And I think you make a really good point that it is kind of thematic. You don't really quite know how much you're going to get done in a day when you're hiking. But I know it's a bit at odds with some of our other games and a lot of other kind of print players or roll and writes, which, you know, often have a fixed number of rounds or you know how much you're going to be able to do. And we went through a lot of different iterations of that. It was definitely the last thing that we pinned down in the design. We sort of knew that we sort of had that movement mechanic. We knew that you have a certain amount of movement. That's how many lines you can cross. But it was like, how do you randomize that? How do you give people, interesting choices. You know, there were versions which had more control, but then it becomes too overwhelming for players because they start planning too many turns ahead. And because if you could sort of think like, okay, I'm going to have two movement this turn, and the next turn I'm going to have four, and then the next turn I'm going to have three, because the movement itself is so freeform, you know, once you get beyond actually a single turn, the number of options just explodes in terms of where you can go and like the number of permutations that you're able to do. And, you know, people were just getting overwhelmed. So we needed something that was really immediate and had some sense of, not predictability, but it had some sense of progression or had some sense of how things might go. So you do have the sense of how quickly the day is going. So if, you know, if you roll high on the first couple of rounds, you're like, oh, well, actually, maybe we're not going to have so many turns, and you might change your strategy for that day. But beyond that, you know, we didn't want anyone to have like too many specifics as to what they'd be able to do on their future turns. And I think the system works quite well. Some other people have proposed a different system. And I admit, if we had the option to have cards, you know, having a fixed deck and flipping from that deck would give a similar idea, but at least would kind of fix the distribution. Because, you know, obviously rolling a die every turn, you have kind of an unbounded distribution. It'd be a different game. But it's something that was probably the most, you know, vexing part of the design, I would say.
Yeah, I'm always curious how some of those design decisions are made.
Sometimes when you reach a decision for something like that, I remember when we finally landed on it, I'm not sure if I felt great. I think I just felt like sort of relieved that we had something that sort of worked. It's a very different feeling to when you have like the initial idea and you're like, oh, this is such a great idea. It feels very expressive. And on the other hand, this just feels sort of very pragmatic of like, we need a solution. And, you know, it's within a time period. But I think it's only in retrospect that you realize, oh, actually, that was the right, you know, like you can sort of trust your gut. It's not just that you're doing something just because it works. You would have thrown it out if it was a problem or if it was sort of problematic for the game. Yeah, there've been a few of our games where, I mean, and just generally in design, where you get stuck on certain problems. I've been lucky enough that, yeah, I've been able to mostly get through them. Or you work with, you know, I always really love working with developers at publishers. I'm a strong, really firm believer that, you know, if I design a game, it will always be better if somebody else develops it. In the, you know, I might get it to 80 or 90%, but it'll always be improved, even if it's only that last 5 or 10% by someone else working on the game. And of course, with Hostmark games, we're locked in to work on our own stuff, so it's not quite the same. But yeah, that's why I think, yeah, the role of developers and good developers is also such a, you know, vital part of making great games in the industry.
Oh my God, yes. I hate when I have to develop my own games.
I do too.
At least, like, give me someone to do it with. Otherwise, it's so hard because, like, you've looked at it for so long, which is why I do tend to work on a ton of projects at one time. And it's partially because I feel like I'll just get bored. But also, I need that time away from a project to have new eyes on it. Otherwise, I just get stuck and I get frustrated.
Well, exactly. Because if you had a good idea about how to develop the game, well, you probably would have done it already, realistically. You know, like when you were designing it, if you could have made it better, you would have made it better. I know you're doing a good job of trying to bring us back to waypoints all the time, but it's another thing in the industry I see more and more, that the difficulty is actually about defining what development work a designer has to do after they sign a game. You know, I think the hardest projects I've ever had is when I do find out I'm the developer. Because that's not really my skill set, actually. Like, I'm much better at the earlier parts of the design process. But you don't always know when you sign a contract necessarily, or things can change in a company. You know, someone might leave or circumstances might change. And even if there is a developer, the extent of work that a designer is expected to do post-contract varies massively, and it's rarely covered in a contract. When I remember talking to some illustrator friends, and they couldn't believe the kind of standards that we've sort of accepted in the industry. Like, they're like, don't you have like a, you know, like a day rate or something, like if they ask you to do anything, you know? And I'm like, no, that's not that would be great, but it's certainly not standard. It's things like that also need to be talked about more, because that also impacts people being able to be full-time, because not only do you not get paid for a long time, projects can just blow out in terms of like the time that you spend on them for basically no more money. Like, you know, if you're developing your own game, yes, you're hopefully making it better, but you're spending a lot of time on something that's not really increasing your cut of it. You know, your royalty isn't going up based on how much development you do on the game. Once it's signed, I should say, like really clearly post-contract. It's another huge part of the industry that I don't exactly know how to solve it, but like the standard needs to change, or at least there needs to be like a new, you know, a new like place where that kind of discussion starts between designers and publishers at the point of signing the contract, I think.
Yeah, I've only ever signed one contract where I had an additional contract for developing that game, which I thought was great. I was like, oh my God, yeah, like that was very progressive. I was like, oh my God, why is this not the standard? But then a lot of times when I'm pitching games, depending on like how far along my game is, so if it's like 80% compared to like 95% or whatever it is, that's where I could get the wiggle room on percentages. So it's like, I can argue closer to like a 10% if I've already done literally all the work and they don't need to hire someone to do it, but it's still hard and it sucks.
Or if they're going to require you to do the work, you know, you might think you've designed it to 95%, but that might be like your version of the game. And of course, every time you sign it with a publisher, they're going to move it towards their version or their market. And that's perfectly normal. And, you know, I'm not saying that because it's such a, you know, it's like how long is a piece of string? Like if a publisher asks me to do certain tasks, yeah, they take me a few minutes and I wouldn't expect them to go through, we need a contract and I need a day rate to do. There's a range of work that I think is acceptable, but it's just so hard to pin down what that is.
Oh yeah, most of my contracts just say reasonable man hours. I'm like, or we could say work hours. Yes, I'm like, does that mean I don't have to do it because I'm a woman? Yeah. I was like, yes.
Yeah. But even that, yeah, like, what, yeah, just like, what is reasonable mean? Yeah, exactly. So it gets back to this same thing that the contracts ultimately don't mean a lot, actually. Like, it's that things that have to move in the industry in terms of how people perceive things, how what they see as people's value and what their responsibilities are, and that's like a kind of cultural thing. It's sort of very slow and a bit hard to pin down changes in that, but it's as necessary.
You've talked about extensions or expansions, but that's another thing that gets overlooked constantly is expansions tend to be a part of the base game contract, which means a lot of times you're not getting paid, you're just getting asked to make this thing that may or may not come out. And a few publishers are nice enough to be like, you know what, I'm going to give you an advance on that expansion. But most publishers are like, you already got your advance on the base game. What are you talking about? You're just going to do this for free. And then it's going to come out and you'll get paid later. And I don't love that. It's terrible.
No, absolutely. 100%. I'm quote unquote a professional designer. And I still miss these, you know, like I work on these series of games with different publishers and I'll be making the next one in that series. And I don't even think, like, oh, I should get it. I mean, I think I should actually say I won't throw them under the bus, because if I asked for it, I suspect they would give me an advance on these things. But you get, like, it's not just the culture of publishers. It's like culture as designers to remember, like, to actually ask for those things. You know, I'm so baked in that, what's the word? I think there's something, it's a bit tricky that, like, when you get started as a designer, I think you, or at least for me, my difficulty was that I thought my advantage or what, like, I was very agreeable to work with. Like, I was, you know, if I was asked to do something, I'd do it. I was, you know, I was quite good at communication. I was good at juggling different projects. And yeah, I think that is important because it does make you easy to work with and it is an important thing. But actually, I'm realizing much later around now, and it's hard for me to change actually, is that that's actually a terrible way to be, you know, a professional who, you know, wants to earn a sort of a stable, reasonable living and not really push, you know, their like work-life balance or mental health or anything like that. If you're constantly, you know, deforming yourself just to fit into what publishers need. And yeah, I completely, when you have so many projects and you just get kind of like emails out of, I always feel like I'm sort of like dancing to somebody else's tune. And that's baked into you so early, or at least it was baked into me. And it's, yeah, it's a really hard thing to get out of, but it's really important. That part of cultural change as well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've definitely gotten better about the front end of contracts and making sure to get things written out better and being better about like saying no to things and being like, hey, yes, I'll do it, but here's my timeline. Do you still need it in this timeline? And if they say, no, we need it sooner, no worries. And then I'll be like, great, bye. Just because, yeah, I've definitely put in way more hours on some games than I should have done. Reasonably, because they did not fit into reasonable hours.
Yeah, I feel like you almost need, I mean, it's a difficult thing anyway, because I think this is like a freelancing problem kind of thing, and it's not unique to games design. And I think a lot of other people in other fields struggle with similar things. It almost feels like we need to get a whole bunch of like freelance. That's why I actually really love listen to like you know, artists and illustrators and writers, and you know, kind of talk about all this kind of creative business stuff, but not from a like I'm going to build a multi-million dollar company and sell XYZ. It's more like, how do I sort of survive as a as a creative professional, and how do I make that stable and healthy? Because in game design, you just have so, you know, we don't even have that kind of body of people necessarily. You know, like the size of everything is just a bit smaller. You don't have that kind of concentration of thought or people kind of bounce things off to really understand, you know, what should I be doing? Like, what's the best way to kind of get through these situations?
Oh, totally. I mean, my goal still in game design is to get to a point where I can be full-time freelance and have enough like royalties coming in and just projects I pick and make the life I want, whether that's choosing to hike for half the day and then work for half the day. Like, that's my ideal future. Will it happen? We'll find out.
Yeah. Well, I wish you all the best. That's the thing that like, I want more people to feel like they could do. And also if they decide to do it, it's not just like you're leaving it up to chance whether that'll happen or not. Like, of course you need like a certain amount of aptitude and you have to show that you can ever do it. But you know, in your case, there's no doubt about that. So it shouldn't be up to like chance or circumstance. I want to see more full-time designers full stop. So
I completely agree. I also want to see that. And I'm not saying like they need to be like filthy rich by
imagination. No, God, no. Just
like livable wages. Like, come on. Yeah. Just be able to live in an apartment or buy a starter home. Like, come on. It shouldn't be that hard.
And to be able to take holidays and feel like that, you know, like to work, you know, the 9 to 5 or something. I think that's, that's also without getting, it's a struggle for a lot of people, regardless of, you know, creative freelancers and things like that. So we're all swept up in that kind of mix, I guess.
Totally. Well, to circle it back to the game that we were talking about, Waypoints.
You've had to keep doing it. I'm sorry, Daniel.
I know, but it's okay, because this is the whole point of this podcast, is to inform people not just about the games they love, but the industry behind it. But no, I mostly just wanted to know, like, did you have like a favorite and a least favorite moment of working on this project?
I think probably the favorite thing was probably coming up with the idea. It still remains, I think, the best idea I probably have for Postmark, realistically. It's one of these things where I always, like, I kind of talk about like resonance in game design, which is like an idea of how well does what you do in a game match to how the thing operates in real life. Not that you have to have a simulation of that thing, but as a player plays the game, how well does that connect to their own experiences? How much can they bring their own, you know, real life experiences? And that's resonance. And I feel like it's such a powerful thing. I think, you know, like games like Wingspan, I think it was such an amazing exemplar of that. Obviously, that's also built on excellent game design, but it's such a rare thing. I think it's quite hard to do. And you obviously could have great games without it. But yeah, it was, I think for me, just having that, not just having the idea of a map game, but having the specific mechanic of how you move through that map connect to something that players, that works as a game, is simple and, you know, you can understand, but also resonates with people in their own way they would expect it how to work. That doesn't happen very often. I don't know how you feel when, you know, when you work, come up with new ideas or that. It's always that moment where you realize like something is going to be a game. Like, you have lots of ideas, but half of them are binned really quickly. And so I'm not sure if that's like the most exciting part. I think for me, it's always the exciting part when you know that, okay, this will be a game. Like, this will work. You might not have ironed out all the kinks, you know, but you sort of know. And I knew that really early on in Waypoints, and that was a really great thing. And probably the hardest thing is, as I said, just crunching those last few bits that were a bit more gamey, that were necessary. And also that we hit a bit of the, like, the difficult part of the constraints of what we built, you know, only having a single sheet and, you know, only having dice. There would probably be kind of more elegant ways to solve those problems without those constraints. So yeah, that was probably the harder thing. Also, the nice and hard thing is making the new map. Sometimes it's really fun when you have a really good idea, but sometimes I think, yeah, it just takes a little bit longer, and then you feel that kind of pressure, like, I really need to come up with something. We want to release like some new content soon, and you kind of feel that time pressure. So that can also be a bit tough. Not that Rory's like whipping me or something, like, oh, we must release in the next week. It's a self-imposed pressure, but yeah, I think that's also a kind of a tricky thing. It's like two sides of the same coin.
And how long did it take from that initial idea to it being sent out after the Kickstarter?
So I started working on the game in March 2023, and we would have kickstarted that at the sort of in November 2023, and it would have been with backers by Christmas 2023. So sort of within 8 to 9 months from start to finish. Obviously, we have some pretty huge advantages being a print play company and also self-publishing, which sort of changes all that time. And also, we were kind of a bit, you know, it was our third game, so we knew how things were working a little bit more. But actually, looking at that, I think that's almost the longest timeline we've had. I think some of the other games have come together much closer to the time. No, that worked out pretty well.
And any future projects you want to plug before we start wrapping this up?
So our website is postmarkgames.com. You can check out all our games there, but you could also sign up to the mailing list there, and we'll very soon announce our latest game, which is going to be kickstarted in July, so quite soon. It's called Master of Coin. It's a kind of Euro-style game. We haven't really done many kind of Euro-style games with Postmark that utilizes coins, like regular coins that I actually had to go to the bank to get some coins because I didn't have enough coins to play with it. But, you know, it'll work with any sort of small. So I think we've made it so it'll work with an American penny, Euro 5-cent piece, and an Australian 5-cent piece. So if you've got a coin of that sort of size, you need 20 of them. So that'll be kickstarting in July, and we're really excited to do that. So check out at postmarkgames.com. We'll have some information there. Or if you look it up on BGG or Google it, it should, you know, the Kickstarter page should come up. That's coming up, and yeah, we'd encourage you to check it out.
Awesome. Yeah. And then for my last question to end the show, if you could have designed a game you didn't design, which do you wish you had done?
I have two answers to this, which is a bit of a cheat. There's one, which is if I would like to just be very comfortable and proud of the design, sort of like, wow, this is a good game and it's made me a bunch of money, would be Codenames, just because all things aside. But actually, my real sort of heart answer as a game designer, because like I'm no businessman, so like I'm not sure if, I mean, I think it's done okay, would be Race for the Galaxy by Tom Lehman, which I think is kind of, I feel like a very old gamer now in a way. Not that I'm that old, but like I've sort of been in the industry for sort of long enough that I realized when I mentioned this game to people, which is my favorite game of all time, and they haven't heard of it. So it's a sort of a tableau building game with, you know, different cards to different powers, but it's extremely fast. It's sort of, you know, 2 players, 15 minutes. I've never seen something that replicates the kind of the, you know, how elegant, how quick it plays, how much variance and exciting moments there are. I've played it hundreds of times. And yeah, Tom Lehman's designer is, you know, such a credit to him. It's an incredible game. It should just be known by more people. Your first few games will be terrible. It is one of the, it's also a bit of a product of its time in that I don't think anyone would release a game like it now, because I think at least for the first 3 or 4 times you play the game, you have no idea.
That was my experience when I played for the first time. And then I was like, oh, I actually did really well. I think I got second, maybe, place.
Well, that's the thing. You won't necessarily have a bad time. It's just that you will not be able to connect what you were doing to, you know, the result. And like, it's just like, does not compute, or like, it's like a different language. It is almost like learning a language. But once it clicks, like in that kind of 3, 4, 5, 5th game, then it just, it kind of flows so well. And yeah, and you can't, it's really hard to make games like that now. I think it's hard to expect players to give the game that kind of many chances. But I would thoroughly say that it is worth that time. And it's also not a crazy long game. Like you're not, you know, you're not pumping in, you know, 3 or 4 hour sessions to make a game. You know, I think even learning games would be within like the 30 to 30 or 40 minutes at worst. Learn at 2 players, also another tip. Or even learn on the app. There's a good app for it now. So, yeah, I feel like I've done a good job of spruiking Race the Galaxy, I guess. I don't know if you're the same, but, you know, I would love to have designed my favorite game in a way. You know, I have games I've designed that I like a lot, but I actually think I'm some of the ones that I love the most are me just trying to emulate Race the Galaxy and maybe getting a little bit close to it, but never quite getting there.
No, I am actually really happy with a few of my games being ones that I actively do want to play. Like Caution Signs is probably one of my favorite party games. I look at it sometimes, I'm like, oh man, I'm so glad that came from my brain. And then there's other ones where I'm like, okay, I think this is a really cool game, super clever, but do I want to play it all the time? No. But if someone's like, hey, can we play Caution Signs? I will say yes every time.
And of course, it's always... it's not only just the game you design, like what it's like to play. It's sometimes also just a function of like how that project went, or how, you know, I probably have games which I really love, but for whatever reason, like experiences as, you know, the kind of business side, it can always change that. So yeah, I'm so glad that you've got like this crystal clear, you know, like a positive memory of the whole experience of it. That means you can you know, enjoy the game as well. And that kind of like all adds together to something you could be proud of and enjoy.
Yeah. And I mean, you also design a lot of games that are, you play it and then you're kind of done and you now have all the secrets. So it's kind of hard to like replay some of those. And I have a few of them coming out this year and next year. So I'm like, well, it's fun to watch someone else play it. And I'm like snickering watching it, but it's like, I can't really experience it the same way.
Yeah. I think it's funny with something like Echoes, which is this audio mystery game. If I had to sort of think about like the one idea like that I might get in my whole career, it would be something like that, which was just like something really, you just can't really think where you got the idea, but it was just exactly the right kind of implementation of that kind of system. And also, you know, I've been very lucky to work with Dave Neal on that game. But yeah, I think in terms of like just feeling like you've kind of contributed something that kind of maybe is not necessarily moved things forward or whatever, but like it's something you kind of feels worthy of a lot of like all that time and effort and kind of expertise, I guess.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I appreciate everyone who was listening to our many, many, many tangents, but I think this episode was fantastic. And for you all listening, this was Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 144, Waypoints. And Matthew, thanks for being on the show. And for anyone trying to find you, I know you've already talked about Postmark Games, but where can you be reached personally if you want to be reached?
Yeah, well, firstly, thank you so much for having me on, Daniel. And thank you, anyone who's still listening. Sorry for... I'm a horrible, horrible guest.
Oh my God, you're not. This has been great. This is what they live for.
Well, I guess if you're still listening at 144, you kind of know what you're getting into. So I have a YouTube channel. It's Matthew Dunstan, and I'm on Blue Sky, also Matthew Dunstan. I'm not necessarily frequent on either, but they're the best places to find me.
Excellent. And I've been your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds, and my social media best places, username Token Gamer, spelled GAYMER. And at Game Design Unboxed on Instagram. We also got TikTok and DMR Creative Group or Board Game Geek if you're looking for me as a game designer. But thank you so much for listening to this podcast. And Matthew, thanks for sharing all the insights as far as how we really need to make this a more equal space for newer and established game designers.
Absolutely. All right, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.